devices are very static sensitive. Even the resistors, even the capacitors. And I can tell you one thing that I didn't think of initially. It's my own little technique. And I realized it was causing some damage. And that is, I use ordinary scotch tape to pick up the components and to hold it in place. Because scotch tape has a sticky surface to it, you can actually store a surface mount component on a piece of tape. And when you fold over that piece of scotch tape, it's never going to go anywhere. Because it's so small and sticking to the tape that is being provided. However, I found that some of this scotch tape generates its own static, and you got to be careful. Because of the structure, and Dick, you could explain this, the materials that they use for making scotch tape sometimes create static on its own, and I've seen where the static from the tape itself destroyed the surface mount component that it was stuck to. I'll pause there for a comment on anything that I said regarding ESD. And when I worked at AIL, Dick, I remember attending a class. It was a three-day class just on handling ESD-sensitive devices. There's a lot to learn about that. And even though it's in the amateur world, I think, you still have to be careful. Dick, so any comments on that?
Yeah, very good subject, Andy. A greater number of the components being manufactured today have electrostatic discharge, ESD, safety devices built into the components, a greater number. However, a significant number of components out there, particularly the older ones, are not ESD safe. On a cold winter day, you walk across a wool rug. Your body can easily pick up 1,500 volts of static charge. You know because you grab a doorknob or some other metal object and you feel that spark. Or you slide your coat across the plastic seat of your automobile as you're getting in or out and you realize a spark jumps. So a human being is around a 500 picofarad capacitor to ground and can easily pick up 1,500 volts. And many of these solid-state components cannot tolerate more than about 10 volts. So the 1,500 on your body can do an awful lot of damage. The easiest solution to that is make sure there's a wrist strap on you that grounds your body and that it is grounded to the workbench or whatever the thing you're working on. Hopefully it's a mildly conducting surface you're working on and you're grounded to it. But there's a catch. Make sure there's at least a half megohm or 1 megohm resistor on that grounding strap connected to your wrist. Without that half megohm resistor, you are an electric shock waiting to happen. If your left hand has the grounding strip across your wrist and is connected to earth ground, and your right hand touches a 60-volt circuit, for instance, there's a chance you could die. So the 1 megohm or half megohm resistor does the job of discharging your body, but it's such a high resistance that the current flowing through that wrist strap will be small enough that it doesn't get you in trouble. In the old days, we used to find out that a human being cannot tolerate more than 200 milliamps of current flowing from hand to hand without potentially getting into an electrical shock, which could send you into fibrillation. The heart goes into a tachycardia, it doesn't pump correctly, and without a defibrillator, you might die. There are different portions of the body where an even smaller amount of current and voltage can get you in trouble. During catheterization, for instance, any current that flows through that catheter while it's connected near your heart, a few microamps could get you into trouble. When it comes to, let me drop, scotch tape. If you Google a set of words called triboelectric, T-R-I-B-O, electric, triboelectric effect. You will get a list of components that are insulating materials, various kinds of plastic and Teflon and whatever are in a particular order. When those two components are brought together and separated, they don't even have to be rubbed. One of those components will attract the electrons faster than the other, and a static charge is built up. Most scotch tape, if you don't buy a very special kind of scotch tape, has a kind of acetate for the main backing of the tape and a particular material for the glue of the tape, which are very far separated on the tribal electric series. Therefore, they build up a huge charge. When you peel a piece of scotch tape off the roll and cut it, you realize that it curls in a funny way. And if you know what you're looking at, you would suddenly realize that the scotch tape has built up an extremely high static electric charge. It could be tens of thousands of volts on that surface of that scotch tape. If you go into an extremely dark room and wait for 20 minutes until your eyes are fully dark adapted, and you then peel scotch tape off the roll and carefully look at the instant of separation of the scotch tape on the rest of the roll, you'll see a dull blue purple glow. That is the X-rays being emitted by the high voltage that's generated at that interface where the scotch tape is being peeled away from the rest of the roll. And if you look at the right website article, you can find a person who used that effect of peeling scotch tape in front of a very sensitive piece of film with another object in the way, and he made an X-ray photograph using as the source of X-rays the scotch tape peeling operation. Obvious that scotch tape is a dangerous material around electrostatic sensitive components. Not very well known. That very simple, innocent looking stuff can do a lot of damage to your circuits. Paper tape, I think, is a hell of a lot safer. I don't think the problem exists with duct tape. But when it comes to gluing things down that you're about to solder, the paper gluing substances that people use for gluing pieces of paper together, they work pretty well. There's probably a whole lot of other sticky substances that can be used that if you need to wash away, you could. Or even there's such inert materials that you don't have to wash them away. These are some of the hints you should know about with surface mounts components. Look what you got us into here, John. W2 Victor Delta Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, fine business, Dick. Yeah, I appreciate all the information. This is very good information I need to know. Yeah, on the scotch tape, I remember as a kid taking, not scotch tape, but that black electrician's tape, and in the dark pulling it away. I always thought that was a line of arcing that was seen right as the tape separated. I didn't realize it was actually an X-ray effect. But I remember seeing a blue line right where the tape was peeling away. It looked like miniature arcing occurring in there. But fine business. Yeah, I'm just taking some notes and, as far as what kind of equipment I'll be getting. But I definitely have to... got to modernize my soldering equipment here because my Weller 250-watt soldering gun is definitely not going to make it. So I really appreciate all the information from the net. Just want to give my thanks to everybody. So back to net.
I think I just want to mention a few more things.
Go right ahead, Andy.
Okay, the other station, I can get your name. And I didn't write your call down. There's a company called Technitool. Maybe you've heard of them. They sell a whole line of soldering and desoldering equipment. And I'm not advertising for them on the air. I'm just mentioning it. You can do Google search for Technitool. They sell Weller. They sell Case. They sell Metcal. OKY, I think it's called. Or just OK is another, the name of the company. And a few others, I just forget the names. They sell soldering and desoldering equipment and special solder and so on that's used for surface mount. Also, you know, be careful. Again, you know, when Dick mentioned the soldering iron and the fine tips, the soldering iron itself should be ESD safe, and they do make soldering irons that have grounded tips where static won't accumulate, a static charge won't accumulate on the tip, and of course when you touch the tip to whatever you're desoldering or soldering, you'll destroy. It'll prevent that from happening. So you could look through the catalog or do a Google search on that too. But there's a whole technique for soldering and desoldering, as Dick mentioned. And, you know, there's a lot more we could talk about on the subject. They say they have classes that last for weeks on just how to do it the right way and the different techniques that are involved. But static is one thing that most people forget, and you got to keep that in mind, especially with the small surface mount components. And like Dick said, some of them are static protected, but a lot of them are not. And you'll have to just be careful with that. All right, that's it. I have to go now. I think I called you over the weekend. Just to let you know, I'll call you this week. Back to you, WTCDO.
K2KEY, want to comment about that?
Mel in a second. Yeah, Andy, I did get the message that you called, and I was sleeping at the time. I kept some pretty crazy hours the night before. And so you and I will talk. Maybe tomorrow night. The choice is yours. Grounding the soldering iron is another very good point. It does pick up a static charge. And it could be running at 60 volts, because the power going to the soldering iron, one of its leads is essentially ground, and the other lead has got 120 volts AC, which goes to 67 volts peak. And because of the capacitive coupling, you could say the iron itself is running at half that voltage, 67 volts. So connecting a wire around the soldering iron that is grounded sounds crazy, but it's a reasonable thing to do. And for a person as a quickie experiment, in order to not spend a whole lot of money, you could take a very simple, old-fashioned Unger soldering iron with one of those little copper round tips to it. You could file the tip to a very fine point, make sure there's a grounding wire on the metal of the soldering iron itself, and with the right magnification and fine enough pieces of solder, you could do this work with very inexpensive equipment. It's not the ideal way to do it, but in a pinch you could do that. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW.
Okay, I'm just looking at the catalog, and it's just funny that I happen to have the catalog very handy. There's a company called Contact East, C-O-N-T-A-C-T, East. And they're available at www.contacteast.com. And in this, it's got everything. They call it for a rework station. And they go from the simplest to most sophisticated. The wrist straps here I'm looking at all have built-in 1 meg ohm resistors. And they have several different kinds made by 3M, in fact. And then they have jackets. You should see all the clothing. And things to go on your shoe. And they call them smocks, unisex smocks, static dissipative unisex smocks. And you'd be amazed at the whole line of different mats and things for the bench. I have a simple couple of grounding mats that these special vinyl mat that they came up with for it actually provides you, it has a wire on the end and you connect it all together. It's got these 1 meg resistors. Now, as far as tape dispenser, they have even special tape dispensers, anti-static tape, it looks like scotch tape, permanent clear anti-static pressure sensitive tape, will not generate static electricity, and it looks just like scotch tape. Exactly, can't tell it apart. And so on and on. So if you're interested, you go to, and then they got bags for storing the boards, anti-static bags, and all this kind of stuff, protective bags. Contact East, very interesting, .com. And what I suggest you do before you you know, dive into a project of repairing your rig or something, pick up something in the street, plenty of junk thrown out that have surface-mounted technology, as you said, and practice it. That's the best of a response I can give, over.
Sure, it does take practice. It would be very tempting at times to pick up a small plastic Ziploc bag that the wife has in the kitchen and put components in there. Don't do it. The majority of the plastics you can get a hold of will build up static charge under certain conditions and could potentially damage your components. So there are very specific, there are very special kinds of pink and silvery colored static resistant plastic bags that should be used on these components. So that's it's a real art form. I have seen people in a pinch use a moderately conducting bench that they're working on, and they didn't have a wrist strap available to them. They were wearing a short sleeve shirt. They made sure that the elbow was continuously pressing against the conducting surface of the bench as they worked on a circuit. I don't recommend this, but in a pinch, without a wrist strap, with a half megohm or one megohm resistor in the wrist strap, you could make sure your body is grounded while you're doing the work and hopefully avoid the static discharge problem. I have run into the problem in a way that I never expected it. On the two occasions that I wanted to replace the failed light bulb that's on the front panel of a Kenwood TR-751A, that's a 2-meter all-mode mobile transceiver, Kenwood TR-751A, and you open up that front panel in order to replace that grain of weed light bulb that's in there so that you have light on the Dawson valve movement, the S meter. And each time I've done that, the rig went crazy. There was enough static charge built up somewhere that the microprocessor really started behaving in very weird ways, and I had to go through the reset procedure. I don't quite remember now. You hold down certain keys as you turn it on, or you press something in the right place. I forget what the reset procedure was, but I had to go through the reset procedure because of the static charge I built up in that operation. So that particular rig, very popular as a tunable IF for microwave frequency people, is very static sensitive when you open up the case. Let me drop. By the same token, my Hewlett-Packard handheld calculators, Hewlett-Packard 15C in the old days, the 28S in the new days, and probably the 50S or C, whatever it is that I'm using now. The case itself of those handheld calculators is made of a conductive plastic. And if you open up the case and plug wires in there because you want to measure the battery current drain under various modes of operation in order to estimate how much life you're going to get on what operation you're doing. And I've done that on each one of my calculators. Well, each time I did that, I got the calculator into some kind of a hang-up mode because I was violating the conductive case by putting materials on the inside of it to make the measurements, and I created a static discharge problem. So you'd be amazed how many things you use are really static sensitive once you remove the outer case or shield or protective conductive plastic cover and so on. Anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
W2JPW question.
Lou recognized. Anyone else?
W2EWK.
Check your email at Shelton West.
Okay. And somebody out there in Smithtown told me to check my email. I'll try to do that. EWK we heard, but first it was Lou. W2JPW, go right ahead, Lou.
Okay, Dick. One question. I used to have a millivac that I used to measure static charges, and it's very interesting, all the stuff you could see. The idea being that you get an idea in your mind of what causes problems and what doesn't. Anyway, I haven't used it in 20 years. It has a chopper inside. I was wondering if I brought it up on a variac to reform any capacitors that might be going a little sour there, if that would destroy the chopper. Go ahead, Dick.
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, that I don't know. Mel, I wonder if you got a guess on that one.
Sorry, got called away for 1 second just to say hello to the lady that we just mentioned. Julia just said hello and said that. Not, she just turned the scanner on. She said, I forgot all about you guys. Just said hello. What was the question, Dick? I'm sorry, I missed it.
Gee, that's too bad that that Julie missed the fact that I've mentioned her name 3 times already. Okay. Lou, make sure you wait until you hear the beep, Lou, and please repeat your question. And your audio is a little bit heavy. Back off from the mic just a tiny bit. W2JBW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Lou.
Okay, sorry, it's after 10 o'clock. I forgot. Yeah, Mel, I have an old, very old millivac. It measures very small static charges, and I haven't used it in quite a number of years. It's in good condition here, but I was thinking of bringing it up on a variac because I don't know how the capacitors in, you know, would be in there after so long of a period of being in storage, so to speak. But it has a mechanical chopper. You can hear the chopper go on as soon as you turn the thing on. My question is, if I bring it up on a variac to try and reform any capacitors that might be a little funny, would that destroy the chopper? Go ahead, Mel.
I don't think so, really. The chopper is with a mechanical device. Maybe you're better off taking it apart and, you know, lubricate it because I guess the moving parts may have dried up by now, Lou. So, maybe a little squirt of WD-40 may go a long way just to make sure that it's not jammed up, you know, so that when you put power to it, doesn't something will burn up in it. That's the only thing I can think of. If the capacitors are not going to form up, they're not going to form up. That's the bottom line. But the mechanics of it, like anything else, like a, you know, that has moving parts, after a period of a lot of years, they glue themselves literally. Maybe put a little WD-40 and work things loose a little bit by hand sometimes helps, rather than, you know, hope for the best that it'll, you know, unglue itself. But for, like, old clocks and things like that, believe it or not, I had an old watch laying in a drawer here, which I wound. It wouldn't work. I opened it up and I squirted WD-40 in it, shook it a little bit, and the thing started to tick, Dick, over.
How about that? So, the chopper you're talking about, I guess I'm not quite sure what it's contained in, Lou, and is it the chopper itself you want to retain its normal operation, or is it that you want to use it to form capacitors outside of the chopper itself? Run that by again, Lou. Go ahead.
No, this is a meter, a high impedance meter to measure very low static charges. It'll go down to in the millivolt level, so you can see all the static electric events on your meter that you were talking about. I used it for everything from putting a wire outside, you know what. Watching what happens when the weather would change and all that kind of stuff. But I haven't used it in 20 years, I guess. And so the chopper is part of the instrument. I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised if the chopper is in some kind of sealed unit. When you hit the switch, you can hear it go bzzz. It's sort of a... It doesn't buzz so much as it's sort of a high-frequency hum. You know that it's running. But I was worried that if I put the thing on a variac and started at, say, 10 volts and worked up to reform any capacitors that had been discombobulated from years of disuse, that I wouldn't ruin the chopper by doing so. Now, Mel said, use some WD-40. I'm not sure I could get the WD-40 in there. I kind of suspect that the chopper is in a sealed unit, but I really don't know for sure because I don't think I ever opened the thing up, or if I do, I don't remember. It's so long ago. Back to that W2JPW.
I think you might very well be worrying unnecessarily, Lou. What was popular about 20 years ago was called a chopper stabilized operational amplifier. When you build an operational amplifier as an extremely high impedance voltage follower, the good news is you get high impedance. The bad news is that without chopper stabilization, you get DC voltage drift in the circuit that will peg the needle, so to speak. So the chopper stabilized technique was a kind of a synchronous demodulator, and the capacitors that are being stabilized by the chopper occasionally short-circuiting those capacitors. Those capacitors are not a very large number of picofarads. As such, they are not the usual high failure type capacitors, those old-fashioned waxed paper capacitors or the slightly more modern tantalum capacitors. Hewlett-Packard, for instance, in the late 80s, made a number of very nice pieces of test equipment, spectrum analyzers and signal generators and whatever. 85, 56, as I remember, is one of the popular spectrum analyzers. 85, 66, 84, 86, 40, I think it is, a signal generator. Anyhow, each one of these things have, when you open up the cover, a very nice set of printed circuit boards for each of the individual voltage regulators. There's a light-emitting diode at the end, a clearly defined set of contacts where you can test if the voltage is present. The light-emitting diode told you what voltage is present. Well, those regulator boards have a liberal sprinkling of 1 microfarad, 35 volt, spray, glass beaded, tantalum capacitors, quality looking capacitors. And after 20 or 30 years, those capacitors have a nasty habit of suddenly becoming a short circuit. And nothing bad happens, just that particular power supply voltage goes to zero. So replacing them is a pain. But in the case of the capacitors you've got on your chopper stabilized voltmeter, which I am guessing has a chopper stabilized voltage follower operational amplifier in the front end, I don't think you have the problem. I don't think you've got to put in the WD-40. I think the mechanical operation of the chopper will automatically wipe those contacts, and they'll eventually be making good contact. But now you're into a subject I'm interested in. I've always wanted to build an electroscope, an electronic detecting device, where I had some kind of a wire hanging outside the house, and as a thunderstorm goes by, I'd like to know what static voltage is built up on that wire. You've apparently done that experiment. I am curious, when you've done that years ago, roughly how many volts did you see under what kind of conditions? I do remember, for instance, that my simple 40-meter dipole that I had hanging outside my house in Farmingdale, way back in 1956. But if I was standing on the basement floor with my bare feet and touched the wire that went to that dipole that was suspended with nice egg insulators in the air, I would feel a tingle that a static charge was being built up on that wire. And so I am curious what kind of voltages you've seen. I would love to have a well-insulated wire that goes to the top of my tower and simply measure what static voltage is built up on it, particularly as a thunderstorm goes by. So what voltage did you see, Lou? W2JPW, K2RIW.
Oh, I don't remember, but I'd say several hundred. Several hundred. I didn't put a very long wire out there, just a few feet. And I think one time I used a plate, the bottom of an old chassis or something, and put it on an insulated support and watched the charge build up. It was in the 100 volt, couple hundred volt range. Dick, go ahead.
Quite often, quite a few of us will pick up the repeater immediately without first waiting for the beep, and we have apparently timed out the auxiliary input to this repeater, which is 147.375, the so-called Eastman input. Maybe if we drop it long enough, it'll come back. Okay, so you've seen several hundred volts, which is what I think I was seeing on my dipole. But with the piece of wire I could have hanging out of the top of my tower, and I'm on a high piece of land in Huntington, I'll bet you I could see some pretty high voltages at times. Really high, because I've seen lightning strike my tower once. And that particular occasion that it happened, it did no damage. The time that I did experience some damage, it wasn't a direct strike on my tower. It was one of these positive lightning strikes, positive polarity, the really potent ones, that struck half a block away. But the surge it put into the 110-volt line damaged a lot of equipment in my house and a lot of the adjacent houses. All experienced a claim on our homeowner policy on the exact same day. I think that was around 7 or 8 years ago. Anyone have any further questions or comments on all of the above, and particularly Paul, if you're present, you might tell us what's going on in space. So WS2N, if he wants to pick up, everybody wait for the beep, K2RIW.
And 2ACG, late check-in.
And Dave, what's going on in Massapequa? And thank you for some of the astronomy stuff you've been mailing me lately. And my guess is you've had a couple of good sightings of the International Space Station plus Space Shuttle when they were separated before the landing occurred. Is that true? Back to you, Dave.
Nope. Nothing like that recently, but I always check the Heavens Above website to see when the next bright pass of the space station is going to be, because those are spectacular. Minus 3 point something has been the brightest magnitude that I've seen so far. But I expect perhaps a minus 4 magnitude when conditions are right. But minus 3 is super. That's a spectacular pass. And anybody that hasn't seen the space station fly across the sky is really missing something. But I had a question. A different topic.
Go ahead with your question. And I just picked up too fast, so wait for the beep.
Okay, this is N2APG, Dave in Massapequa. I have a Radio Shack scanner that has a liquid crystal display, LCD display. I have an LED flashlight that has two intensity settings, a bright setting and a not-so-bright setting. When I look at the liquid crystal display under normal conditions, it looks fine, normal. The numbers are just as you would expect. When I shine the LED flashlight at the display and look at it, I get a very strange image. On the bright setting with the flashlight, the display is as it should be. You know, nice and solid and no signs of movement. However, when I use the not-so-bright LED setting, the display seems to undulate. That's the best way I could describe it. It seems to flicker, fluctuate. I was wondering what's going on there.
Now, I've got a guess. And my guess is that the dimmer setting of the light-emitting diode flashlight is not just simply lowering the voltage. You're putting the equivalent of a square wave with a 50% duty cycle into the light-emitting diodes. Light-emitting diodes work very well at a specific voltage. You put any voltage lower than that, and their performance is not very well defined. Put any voltage greater than that, and you could easily damage them. So dimming circuits are done by flashing. So you've now got a stroboscopic effect taking place between the dim setting of the flashlight and the refresh rate that's going on with your liquid crystal display. That's what I think is going on. You're looking at a stroboscopic effect. Also, the way some light-emitting diodes work, they really have a kind of polarizer built into them. And as such, if you took that flashlight and rotated it around its axis, so you change the polarity of the signal coming out of the light-emitting diodes, there's a slim chance that you'll see a change in the display when you do that. Now, where I really ran into this problem was I had a beautiful display on the screen of my Hewlett-Packard handheld calculator. I wanted to make a Xerox copy of what was on the screen to publish it to somebody. I tried every possible setting of the Xerox machine. Nothing came out but a blank screen, even though my eye said that's a beautiful picture. the polarized light coming out of the illumination source for the Xerox machine and the angle at which the light was hitting the display. That combination was such that it saw none of the alphanumerics on the screen of the handheld calculator. I couldn't find a way of getting a picture. And so that taught me a few things. Anyone have any further questions, any suggestions on the stroboscopic effect that Dave is describing? I've also noticed, let me drop, that human eyes are very flash sensitive in the peripheral vision. The way I first discovered that is that when I went over to the United Kingdom and I looked at their television screen, which doesn't operate at 60 cycle power, it runs on 50 cycle power, therefore the screen is refreshed 25 times per second. And when I would look across the room, not directly at the television set, but the television set was in my peripheral vision, I would sense the fact that it was flickering. By the same token, there are some of the modern-day automobiles where the taillights are light-emitting diodes. And if I look off to one side, I will recognize the fact that those light-emitting diodes are flickering. They're flashing. They're pulse-operated to get a particular dimness to them that becomes brighter when you step on the brake. They change the pulse duty factor. So I wonder if anyone has experienced this and has any comments to make on it all. Particularly Glenn, if he's available, KC2QIQ, K2LIW listening. Heard an extremely noisy signal. I guess it's possible it was K2IO. Who was that extremely noisy signal? I'm going to listen on the input and see if I can catch you. Somebody is transmitting pure white noise instead of audio. Got enough carrier into the machine, but there is no audio. I'm sorry to say we can't hear what you're saying. Why don't you make one more attempt? I'm wearing earphones. I barely heard you say, I'll wait till the next blank YJC is what I think I heard you say. Is that true? YJC. I'll be back this week. Okay? Is there any way you can make a change of your position right now to change the signal strength? Go ahead. Okay, no audio that time. See, one of the things that happens, quite often a person will be using a handy talkie. He positions the handy talkie until he gets a nice strong signal from the landmark repeater. And then he proceeds to talk back. And you might not realize that the talking frequency and the listening frequency are not the same. So the position in three-dimensional space where your handy talkie gets the best signal on reception might not be the same position in space where the repeater gets the best signal that you transmit. You have to try another position. So randomly choose some other position. Orient the handy talkie horizontal, vertical, in, out, up, down, left, right. See if you can find a position, Mr. YJC, where we can hear you. Make another attempt, K2RIW. Okay, nothing came through that time. There's a subject that I want to discuss, which in my opinion is lethal, potentially lethal to ham radio operators, as well as other operators. Now, 3 or 4 days ago, I brought that particular subject up on this particular repeater. For those people who had that discussion with me then, please temporarily keep quiet. You've got some inside information. But then we're going to want to hear your comments later on. What I'm talking about is the situation where Toyota is about to recall 4 million automobiles because of the so-called stuck accelerator problem. It appears as though in many cases the stuck accelerator happens because the wrong rug is put in, or the rug is not properly tied down with its little black hook, and the rug moves forward and jams the accelerator pedal into a high-speed chase. There are people who think that there is something that can happen with the emission control computer and or throttled assembly, which is partially electronic these days, and that the motor gets a command to go to full throttle when you didn't request that. Anyhow, what has happened to some number of people, and there's a particular case where four people died in California a month or two ago, where the accelerator got stuck into the high velocity mode. The car was moving at 120 miles an hour. The woman got on her cell phone, called her husband, who worked in law enforcement in California, and the brakes were not working well enough, and for a very good reason. She eventually went over the cliff, and she and all the children in the car died because the car went 120 miles an hour. When that situation occurs, where the throttle of the automobile suddenly goes wide open, by the time you realize what's going on, you might be moving 70 or 80 miles an hour. If the engine's at full power, and you're already moving 70, and you try applying the brakes, the total amount of heat you're applying to those brakes is so fierce that there's a high probability you will glaze the brakes. You can put them on as hard as you want. You're not going to stop that automobile. Instead of it go to 120, it'll go to 110, if you know what I mean. The brakes, when you're beyond a certain velocity, the car has more go than woe. That's not very funny. Of the people who are listening to my voice, I'm about to ask you a question. Let me drop. And the reason I'm asking the question is because I think our media, our newspapers and television stations are failing us in this particular circumstance, that I'm amazed that they are so naive to fall into this particular trap, and it's a lethal trap. Toyota, because they're recalling 4.1 million automobiles, it's going to take them 6 months to do it. So therefore, for a significant number of people, this potentially dangerous condition of a runaway automobile will exist for the next 6 months. On top of that, what they're going to do is either remove the mats or replace the mats with another brand of mats that are safer, and they're going to shorten the length of the accelerator pedal by cutting off a little bit of the length of the end of it. That strikes me crazy. That reminds me of arranging the deck chairs on the Titanic while it's sinking. Craziness. That's too little too late. We need a solution a hell of a lot sooner than that. Each of the news reports that were on, all of our news reports about four or so days ago, went into all kinds of elaborate description of what Toyota's going to do, what various people think the problem is, and so on. In the old days, the FCC used to insist that for you to have a license to have a broadcast station, you must serve the public. You must give them not only what they want, but what they need. There's a drastic need for information in this case. But let me throw the question out. You're in your automobile. All of a sudden, the engine goes full throttle. You're flying down the road at some extremely high velocity, and it's increasing. You stand on the brakes with all you've got, and it doesn't do anything. Tell me what you do next.
Turn the bloody thing off.
Absolutely. Put it in neutral or turn the key. Why the hell hasn't that information been given to us? Why in the world did Toyota or the news broadcasting media tell us that? You can always shift a car into neutral. I'll admit that an unloaded engine with a wide open throttle might go to a high RPM. There's a chance that the engine what might be damaged. Or you can turn off the key. But you got to be careful with turning off the key. Only do it for the first click. If you turn the key all the way off,
you can't dip it in gear.
Many cars, the key, if you could turn it off all the way, will go into a lock steering. But which do you do first? Put it into neutral or turn off the key? I'm not sure. However, it's one of these situations where you must practice it ahead of time, mentally, to know what you're going to do when the circumstance occurs. This woman was flying down a highway at 120 miles an hour. For the next 5 or 10 minutes, she's on the cell phone talking to her husband. What they ended up doing was praying over the cell phone. Why in the world that man in law enforcement that she's talking to, her husband, didn't tell her to turn off the key or put it into neutral, I don't know. He just didn't think about it. He hadn't thought about it ahead of time. That's a very vital piece of information. If you disconnect the power of that engine from your wheels, no matter what velocity it's running, no matter how far that throttle is stuck open, in theory you stand a chance of now slowing down that automobile. When it's engaged, you don't. You guys probably have a lot of comments on all of the above. Try giving me your call letters, K2LIW.
And to APG.
That's on a Mercedes.
Okay, I heard APJ, KEY, and EJ in that order. Dave first, go ahead.
Okay, N2APJ, real quickly, on the problem at hand, you're absolutely correct. You have to disconnect the power and absolutely shift it into neutral and turn the key off. But two things I wanted to mention on that same topic, the situation. Anytime you have a situation like this where something happens while you're driving your car, whatever, I think the biggest problem among the average driver is that it's a disorienting condition. And the average driver, even experienced drivers, may be disoriented for a couple of seconds because they don't understand what's going on and they can't relate to it. And I think that's the big problem.
You're absolutely right, Dave. They become disoriented, and after that they act in the panic mode as opposed to the rational mode. Therefore, they must be given the information ahead of time. I am extremely disappointed that the majority of the defensive driving courses do not cover this subject. I've taken 3 defensive driving courses, maybe 4. This subject was not covered. Somebody did tell me they went to a driving course where it was covered, but it seems to be rare. It's not in the manuals recommended by the Motor Vehicle Department, at least I haven't found it yet, that you have to know how to disconnect a modern automobile from those wheels. Okay, Mel, K2KEY, go ahead.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Happened to my brother. Jeez. He was backing out of his driveway, and all of a sudden the engine took off at, like you say, 100 miles an hour. He, my brother's an experienced driver. He's been in the automobile associated business most of all his life. And at the time it happened, he was a guy in his 50s. I mean, he's an experienced driver. He says, Mel, it happened so goddamn fast. He says, I punched down on the brake, and he says, and the wheels were spinning like heck, and I got it out of gear. He says, but if I shot out into that street, he was backing, like I say, out of his driveway. He says, Mel, if a car would have come along, I would have smashed him. It happened so goddamn fast. He says, I took off like a bat out of hell, literally. And he says, and that engine was going 100 miles an hour. He says, the speed of that engine. He said, I thought the thing was going to fly apart. And so he just, out into the street. People, everybody was looking at the way the wheels were squealing. He took just about 20,000 miles off the tires in within a couple of seconds. So it happened so goddamn fast. Anything, I mean, you know, when I was flying my plane, and many times, a lot of people used to make a remark that, you know, it's hours and hours of enjoyable, you know, recreation flying, but can wind up in a few seconds of total terror, and that's what happens, Dick. Until you experience, you can't imagine how quick your mind sort of loses track of what's going on, and you just get so panicky over it.
Boy, is it good that your brother knew to put it in neutral. Very few people would have done that under that panic. And that's the problem. What makes me very unhappy when I watch the news reports that night, I watch CBS, ABC, NBC, PBS, all of them. Because there's such a major problem, which is so life-threatening, and it's going to take 6 months to solve it, and because it's so extensive, 4 million automobiles, this is the biggest recall in the history of automobiles, to my knowledge. And Toyota's going to be recalling all of them. It's going to cost them a tremendous tremendous number of dollars to do all this. Each one of the news reports went on for a significant number of minutes, describing the situation, describing how bad it is, describing how various denials are going on, describing how long it's going to take to fix it, all kinds of description. Not one single word telling the consumer what to do in that panic. How in the world does that many human beings become that short-sighted? That such a vital piece of information was not conveyed to the consumer. How the hell did that happen? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Hey, K2RIW, KE2EJ. What makes you think all those people are bright? Yeah, you're right about that, Dick. But you can check in just about any car that was made after, was it 96 or 97, I forget. But without the key in there and the wheel, steering wheel lock, most vehicles you can't take out of park to start with. Anybody that's driven a manual in their life, not going to have an issue with that. The instinctiveness is there for them. You know, even if you had that problem in a manual, people are smart enough to put their foot down on a clutch and they know they're going to slow down no matter what the engine's doing. The other issue, of course, is that panic is something that has pretty much unpredictable characteristics in a person that hasn't been trained. That's why even EMTs, it takes a while for them to get used to the stuff that they have to deal with and not lose their own self-control, so to speak. But given that, you know, a life-threatening situation happens, the adrenaline kicks in, and that takes over first, but this woman was on her cell phone, so you figure she already got through that part of it. And by the way, if you were to turn the key, it won't go to the lock position as long as that gear shift lever is anything other than park. And should you actually put it into park, people think that the transmission will just blow up, but there's actually a latching mechanism in there. And it knows when the car is moving, you'll hear it until the thing finally slows down. So, there are things there, but the public at large doesn't really get an education in driving, per se. Anyway, all you have to do is look at the idiots on the road. K2RW, K2J.
It's real easy to call a particular group of people idiots, though, Eric. You gotta be careful about that one, in my opinion. Because people grew up in a particular environment where they were not exposed to a particular piece of information they need, can you blame them for not having that vital piece of information? Sometimes the answer is no. But this is one of those situations where panic can easily occur. Whatever you do, like getting on the cell phone and praying with somebody, quite possibly that prayer is not going to be answered. That's not necessarily the best answer. You have to think ahead of time. You have to be instructed ahead of time that if the engine does anything you don't like, either find a way to stop the engine from running, the key is one of the first ways, or at least find a way of disconnecting it from the wheels, put the car into neutral. On a most modern day automatic transmission, when you're in drive, all you've got to do is shove the lever forward, it'll go into neutral, and it won't go into reverse before you press the button. Don't press the button. Don't try to put it into reverse. Certainly don't try to put it into park. On most automobiles, you have to go through reverse before you can get to park. You don't want to put an automatic transmission into reverse while you're rolling forward, and certainly not when you're rolling forward at high speed. I'd like to believe there's lockout mechanisms in the computer of the automatic transmission that will not let you do that.
Well, that's mechanical.
It's not always true. I managed to get a vehicle into reverse by mistake once while I was rolling forward, and the net result was I broke the drive shaft and it dropped down to the road, and if I was moving fast enough ahead, in theory, a drive shaft laying on the road can flip the car over. So you can, in some cases, on older automobiles, get them into reverse while you're moving forward. Don't do it. So, but the main thing is get the car in neutral or kill the engine with the key. Don't depend on the brakes. The brakes work beautiful from, let me pick a number, 60 miles an hour down to zero. If you're already moving 80 and you've got an engine flat out, open throttle, the power it can generate and the heat of your brakes are such that the two are not compatible, and your chances of stopping that automobile with the brakes is near zero. I don't care if you've got disc brakes, drum brakes, whatever. You're going to glaze them. The total amount of horsepower or watts of energy you're putting into those brakes is going to make them glow. You'll probably warp the disc, warp the drum, and glaze the brakes, and you're not going to get braking for whatever reason. You can't depend on the brakes. You watch the space shuttle, which lands at something like 260 miles an hour. It does not start off with the brakes. It uses a parachute at high velocity. Real high velocity, if you use the brakes, you would make the drum so hot you'd be...
This is the W2VL repeater.
At real high velocity, you use the brakes full speed, full force, so to speak, you'll generate an amount of heat that will probably catch your tires on fire. And it's happened on a couple of occasions. High-speed landings where the pilot was coming to the end of the runway, he had no other way of stopping the aircraft, and he had to stand on the brakes. Lots of damage occurs. So at real high velocities, you can't use the brakes. By the same token, if you understand the physics of what's going on, and you're coming down from Pikes Peak or some other high mountain, and if you decide that, gee, I want to get down there in a hurry, and I'm going to get down there at 60 miles an hour instead of 30 or 20, and the assumption that the road is doesn't have enough curves, but it's still got a downhill lie, and you start doing that, the amount of heat you create in the brakes when you're riding them and coming down at, let's say, 60 instead of 20, you think there's only a 3-to-1 difference. It's probably a 50-to-1 difference in the amount of heat that you're generating. First of all, you should be doing it with the transmission as well as the brakes, but don't come down a long, steep mountain at high velocity and think that your brakes are going to save you. Again, you can easily glaze them and overheat them. A buddy of mine loaned his automobile to somebody who went to a high mountain in Colorado, and when he got the vehicle back, the disc brakes were warped, and the fairly new pads were heavily damaged. They were down to the metal in a very short period of time. So it was obvious to him that what they had done is they had come down the mountain at a very high velocity. So you have to plan on these things ahead of time. There's at least two places where you have to think ahead of time, because common sense will not work. One, when your vehicle goes into a body of water, do not close the windows. Open the windows. It's opposite of common sense. You think you're going to keep out the water. Well, you'll drown if you do that, because you're not going to open those doors when that car goes in the water. Your only way of getting out is you're going to swim out of a window. Start opening the windows real fast. Don't even sit at a dockside where you could potentially do something wrong with the transmission and end up going in the water with a vehicle with the key turned off so you can't operate the windows. You got to think about these things ahead of time. So going into water, open the windows. Going at high speed with an automobile that's got a stuck accelerator, think about disconnecting the engine or stopping the engine. Don't depend on the brakes. And so many, many minutes of all of those news reports gave none of that information. It's going to take at least 6 months to solve this problem for this particular automobile. I guarantee periodically it happens with other automobiles. That general piece of information has to be propagated. How in the world does Sedan many smart people and Sedan many news industries not realize that that basic piece of information is given? I can almost understand how the legal... Let me drop it. I can almost understand how the legal beagles at Toyota have scared the living daylights out of that chain of command and said, do not give out information like recommending going into neutral or turning off the key. That would be admitting there is an error in the automobile, and they can't do it. So Toyota is not going to do it. But we have to send out that information to our friends that we want them to stay alive, that they have to think about this situation ahead of time, because it will not occur as common sense when you're under the real panic situation. You can see I'm a little hot under the collar on this one, because I think we've really missed a golden opportunity to give people a drastically needed piece of information. It's not too late. We amateurs have got smart friends, and we're going to tell them. K2LIW listening. Anybody got any further comments?
K2LIW.
302, okay.
Thing, I'll tell you about my brother, what happened.
Okay, I heard about quadruple in there. I heard KO2OK and K2KEY coming out on the top of the... We'll get you all the others, don't worry. KO2OK first, go ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Don't forget me, Dick.
Okay, Dick, this is Bennett, KO2OK in New Jersey. Not my opinion, but I saw a news report and an interview with a safety expert, supposedly, on one of the morning shows. And here's two things. Regarding turning off the car, they said, you turn off the car, you lose all power. I'd like to give this a try, even at 30 miles an hour on an empty road somewhere. What happens if I turn off the key? How hard is it for me to stop a car with, power brakes? And you also lose the power steering depending on what road you're on. That could be also dangerous. And as far as disconnecting the transmission, another thing I want to try is to start up from a dead stop and as it's accelerating, try to put it into neutral. And they're saying some cars, I don't know about the Toyota, you may not be able to. It's got such a, the gears or whatever is, all meshed together and you would have a hard time just trying to push it into neutral. Not my opinion, just something I heard on one of the morning shows. And back to net. Thanks, Dick. KO2OK.
Eugene, we're going to get to you. Don't worry. Bennett, good information. And I'm left to believe that the method by which the automobile's automatic transmission gets into neutral is it disconnects the clutch plates on the torque converter or loosens up some bands. In either case, that's not a function of meshing or unmeshing gears. You're not moving gears in the case of an automatic transmission. Those planetary gear systems continuously stay engaged. You're just deciding which clutch plates and which bands do or don't become tightened. That's a servo mechanism, a servo motion, a piston-like device, if you know what I mean. There was another comment I was going to make. Forgot it. Oh, yes. When you put it into, if you turn the engine off and you think you're going to lose power steering, you're absolutely right. That is not bad. The power steering is only required when the vehicle is not rolling forward. When you're doing parallel parking and you've got very little forward motion, turning the wheels is hard and you need power steering. On most automobiles, the power steering essentially goes to zero when you're rolling more than 30 miles an hour. You don't need power steering when the car is rolling straight forward. So losing power steering is not bad. Every power braking system has a vacuum reservoir where you get approximately two more full braking actions with the engine turned off. You can run that experiment. As long as it's working correctly, you've got a vacuum reservoir on your power braking. So you do have braking with no engine running, at least one or two full braking cycles. K2KEY, K2LAW, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, from my brother's experience, he says, Mel, if I didn't get a heart attack, it was a miracle. Not only did the thing take off like that, but to get the thing to go out of gear, you got to get down on the brakes. And when the engine and the thing was going like that, he says, I have to, he says, it didn't, he's used to, on the console, just easily, when his car, of course, is standing still, to go from neutral to drive or from drive back to neutral, it's, fairly easy. He says, when this thing was going like that, he says, I had to work it. He says, for some reason, I says, guess the braking system or whatever getting screwed up with the wheels going like that, he had to put some muscle behind it to get the goddamn thing, he says, back into neutral from drive, from reverse. He was going, out his driveway. In the meantime, he says, it's so quick it happened, he says, that he spun around. He went out to the street, and when he got it under control, he had spun around, Dick, 180 degrees. Can you imagine if anybody was coming along and he got out of, I don't know what kind of, like, he says, I would have killed somebody, he says, because I was traveling, he says, like a bullet. He says, and I just swung around there, and he says, at 180 degrees, lucky just as it was coming in back into neutral. So, it's a heck of an experience, and I, it's very hard to prepare for such a thing like that, Dick. I guess because even experienced drivers, I think, could really get into a real quick panic situation. Over.
KC2, QIQ.
Okay, here you go. Glenn recognized.